You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about a state program that helps place graduating physicians in Wisconsin's rural areas.
First, an upcoming Wisconsin festival looks to celebrate the contributions made by people with disabilities in and around the state's capital city. The 5th Annual Disability Pride Festival takes place this Saturday in Madison and brings together artists, musicians, disability advocates, and many more.
Kate Moran joins us now to talk more about the festival and what to expect from it. Kate is president of the board for the group Disability Pride. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Well, we'll get into some of the specifics in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, what role do you think that the Disability Pride Festival serves?
Well, I think it's a chance for people with disabilities to come together and unite with other people who are like them, meet other people like them, share their challenges, share their successes, and for all of us to appreciate how much everyone contributes to our society, but especially people with disabilities contribute.
And can you tell us a little bit about how the festival first got started?
Well, there's a Disability Pride Parade in Chicago that I think is about 14 years old now. 15 it would be, because two people from Madison, Sarah Karen and Karen Milstein, went down there to see the parade, and they ran into Jason Glazier, who's our civil rights disability specialist, and they said, we should do this here in Madison. So I ran into Sarah in the parking lot of where we worked about 3 months after that, and she said, well, we need some help, and so I jumped in, and we got grants from the Madison Arts Commission, from Dane Arts. Kathy Truba from the McBurney Center at that time came in and donated the sign language interpreters. MG&E jumped on board, and off we went.
So it's been a group effort there. Can you tell us a little bit more about the events and the activities that go on?
Well, it's really grown. We've always had a main stage, and this year we're really excited to have Galen Lee back again. Last year she won NPR's Tiny Desk Concert, and she's an amazing violinist who plays with a looping machine and creates these just amazing sounds.
I have seen her, yeah. That's a special person to have there for sure.
Yeah, so there will be a stage. T. Banks from Black Lives Matter will be emceeing the stage, and he'll be fantastic. So then there's also a karaoke stage, or for people who want to perform, there will be a climbing wall where we'll be talking about adaptive climbing, and there will be food, and there is about 50 exhibitors.
How many people typically come?
Well, last year we had 450, and we were in Brittingham Park. This year, because they're building an accessible playground in Brittingham Park, we had to move to Tenney Park. So we think we might even have more people at Tenney. We are having a lot of excitement and a lot of buzz this year.
Do you think the part of the idea behind the festival is maybe to clear up misconceptions about just what a disability is?
Absolutely. It's showing everyone that there are things that people with disabilities are doing that are valuable, amazing, and wonderful.
And have you had people be surprised at what they find there when they come?
Well, absolutely. People are surprised, and people are thrilled, and people are excited to meet other people working on the same issues that they are. I mean, this year our community is facing tremendous challenges with, you know, tonight's threat to Medicaid, and so many people have been able to leave institutions using that program that we've really been fighting for our lives. So it's time to celebrate and be together.
Kate Moran is with us right now. She's president of the board for the group Disability Pride. The Disability Pride Festival takes place this Saturday in Madison. And Kate, if people are listening to you talk and think it sounds cool, how can they get involved?
Well, I'd say come to the festival at this date. I mean, we're a day and a half from it. Please come to the festival. Check it out. It's going to be fun for everyone. There are lots and lots of different vendors. Lots of people have come together with this. We have a wonderful webpage that lists all our sponsors. There's going to be crafts. There's going to be a special children's area. And because we're in Tenney Park, MSCR is going to be offering free accessible pontoon boat rides.
Oh, nice. And is this a community that continues after the festival ends? Is there a community around this?
Oh, yeah. And we're talking even more about our plans for next year. You know, we're looking at doing some theater producing in the fall. We're all about just getting the talent of people with disabilities, magnifying it, boosting it, making sure that their voices get heard.
Do you have any big dreams for the festival, blue sky stuff that you're really hoping to get off the ground in the next year or two?
Well, I think just growing, you know, at the rate we've been growing, we've been picking up 75 to 100 more participants a year. And that's a good, healthy growth for an organization that's all volunteer with no paid staff. You know, and we need to grow slow so that it doesn't get beyond us. But it's been a great, great experience for everyone involved.
We've talked to some people on the program maybe who have a new disability and struggle with adapting to changes they might have to make in their life. Is coming to this festival a place to start maybe to meet some people and connect with a community?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll bring up the case of my partner, Sashi Misher, who worked for years at Room of One's Own, so folks might know her from State Street. But she started working on the festival because I started. I had a disability, and she at first was like, what is this all about? And then the second year, she became diagnosed with myasthenia gravis. And it's been incredible for her to have this community of activists to grow into. Yeah, disability is one of the few minorities that we're really not looking to grow. You know, nobody wants to be more disabled. Mm-hmm. But people who are disabled keep going. There is so much life after a diagnosis. You know, there are some groups like Madison Spinal Cord Injury that make that their mission, to go in and let other people know how much there is to do. One of the great things about the festival that you can see that you can't always see in Madison are adaptive bikes. We bring up Creative Mobility from St. Charles. And the rumor that someone told me the first year is that there was only one adaptive bike to be bought in Madison and you couldn't take it out of the showroom. So here we are. Hal comes with a whole trailer full of probably about 200, 300 bikes with all kinds of adaptations. And, you know, people can get on bikes again who haven't been on bikes in decades.
Okay, that sounds great, and I wish you a great weekend and good weather. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kate Moran, president of the board for the group Disability Pride. The Disability Pride Festival takes place this Saturday in Madison. Close to a third of Wisconsin's population lives in rural areas, but only 13% of physicians have practices located in these communities. And our next guest has been taking steps to help change that trend.
Joining us now is Byron Kraus, director of the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine. Byron, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some exciting things that we're doing to try to address the shortage of physicians in rural Wisconsin.
Great. Well, we're really looking forward to hearing about it. So can you tell us about the goals of the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine?
Well, the Wisconsin Academy is a program that, within the School of Medicine and Public Health that we've really designed to attract people from rural Wisconsin with an interest in serving people, combining their interest in science and health, in becoming a physician, and returning to rural Wisconsin to meet the needs of our citizens throughout rural Wisconsin.
So what are the biggest needs in getting physicians practicing in the rural areas? Are there particular specialties, or who are you trying to especially get out into those areas?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. When we started the program, we're just finishing our 10th year of the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine. When we began the planning for this, and we met with representatives from rural hospitals, rural clinics, providers in rural areas, I think everybody affirmed kind of what we see both in Wisconsin and nationwide, that the specialty and greatest need and greatest demand is family medicine. But everybody we spoke with, before they could take another breath, would say, but we need a general surgeon, we need a psychiatrist, we need a radiologist, and the list would go on. So even though family medicine and primary care is the greatest in demand, essentially all specialties were needed. So as we developed the program, we really designed it in a way that we could promote and hopefully nurture that interest in family medicine and primary care. But at the same time, really developed a program that was fairly unique around the country in rural focus programs to support people pursuing any specialty with a rural need and meeting the needs in rural Wisconsin.
Byron, take us into these communities. Can you give us a sense of what the real life consequences are of this shortage of physicians in rural areas?
Well, again, this is the human side of this that sometimes is lost when we just look at numbers and statistics. But really what it comes down to is when in rural communities, a typical small town of 1,500 to 3,000 citizens may have, 5 or 6 physicians there. So when you're dealing with a physician or a husband and wife, if there's two, kind of a married physician wife leaving, also that represents, somewhere 20 to 30% of their workforce leaves when one person leaves. There isn't a depth or a deep bench of backup. What that does to patients and to residents in those areas, it creates another access problem in terms of getting in to be seen, access to services. There's just a delay. So, again, a lot of what we try to do within the primary care world is to address problems early, prevention, early intervention. And if people have to be delayed because there just isn't access to be seen, that delays that whole process and results in disease being more advanced, more complicated, more expensive, more side effects when we come to the treatment side of things.
And I'm guessing also that people that might need to see a specialist, that could involve significant and frequent travel that may or may not be very easy for them to do.
We frequently talk about travel burden when we talk about what does it mean to have rural and rural accessing issues. And you're right on target with that. In rural areas, we know that people tend to be less insured, they tend to be older, there tends to be more poverty, and that whole socioeconomic challenge results in challenges in travel. So it may be the case that if they have a car that's going to travel and be able to make a trip to a specialist 50, 80, 100 miles away, then it gets into the issue of do they have enough gas, money, and will they be able to make the trip or not. So that, again, we look at more physicians interested in rural practice. The specialists are doing more outreach and kind of sometimes we bring the physicians to the community. Telemedicine is another thing that we're looking at evolving and it's developing to provide more access to the specialists in the rural areas. But again, as you identified in your earlier questions, we still need that primary care base to support the ongoing core health care services, the thing can be supported and utilize those specialty and subspecialty services.
We're talking with Byron Kraus. He's director of the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine, and we're looking at their efforts to encourage new physicians to set up practice in the rural areas of Wisconsin. And Byron, one thing I'm curious about is, has there always been this type of shortage, or is this a newer development and is it getting worse?
I would say that this has really been a pretty chronic, long-term problem that we've, within the state of Wisconsin, there's a designation that's called health professions shortage areas, where we're looking at inadequate numbers of physicians, psychologists, other health professions. There's about two-thirds of our counties are designated as health profession shortage areas. Of those, 75% represent the rural counties. And this has been a long-standing, many-year type problem. In the last years, there's been more discussion about the general health care workforce shortage, physicians, pharmacists, nurses, basically all health professionals. But as we look at those numbers and increasing shortages and predicting in the case of physicians in the year by 2025 nationwide, 25 to 30,000 physicians. But what you look at is that's on top of shortages that we have already. Mm-hmm. So we're dealing with existing shortages, and the projections are for even greater shortages, which will further compound the rural communities. as I mentioned earlier, there just isn't that depth. And so if you lose a physician in Milwaukee or Madison, it's almost hardly noticed. I mean, of course, there's individual patient-doctor relationships that are impacted. But in terms of overall numbers, it's not noted. In a rural community, one physician leaving, retiring, moving, has a huge impact on the access to services in those communities. And so that's why, you know, again, sometimes the numbers don't really tell the whole story of how significant, how critical this shortage is.
Are we graduating enough medical students who become doctors to cover all areas of the state, or are we actually looking at a shortage of enough doctors, period?
Well, that's a great question, and the ability to predict into the future is always a challenge, whether it be in many areas, in health physician workforce needs, health provider workforce needs. It's always been a challenge in getting that prediction, but there's been pretty much universal prediction that there has been a shortage. So in Wisconsin, there's been a lot of initiatives that really have been addressing this. The Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine through the School of Medicine and Public Health, we started that about 10 years ago. The Medical College of Wisconsin has started there, has kind of moved into looking at helping with rural issues, and in the last couple of years developed their campuses in Wausau, in Green Bay, with that same focus on trying to help increase the number of rural physicians. So on the medical school level, we've been seeing both medical schools in the state increasing their class size and meeting that need. As you probably know, and the listeners are aware of, Judith, after medical school, then we specialize in going to what's called residency education, where we develop our training for a specialty, whether it be family medicine, surgery, obstetrics, gynecology, et cetera. So that's another training program. And so the state has also been really quite responsive in trying to help us expand, now that we're expanding the number of medical students, expanding the number of residency programs in the state to further train more people here in the state. You know, we've looked at the data, and we know that if a Wisconsin resident does their medical school training in Wisconsin, does the residency training in Wisconsin, we're looking at almost a 90% probability they'll go practice in Wisconsin. And if they go elsewhere for medical school, elsewhere for residency, the chance of their practicing in Wisconsin drops significantly. So we really need this continuum of medical student training as well as residency training. And when we look at the rural issues, the more time we get them in the rural communities, the more they have an opportunity to kind of continue to nurture that interest in rural, see that they can really make a difference and have that meaningful practice in the smaller community, and really help address the disparities of healthcare that exist here in Wisconsin.
And you said that the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine has been around for about 10 years. How successful would you say it's been so far?
Well, in the Midwest, we hate to brag, but I will brag for a moment.
Oh, go ahead.
We've had 120 graduates from the WARM program. We've significantly increased the number of graduates over our normal medical school's output in terms of staying in the state for residency training. As I mentioned, they graduate mm-hmm. from medical school, then go on to residency. We've got now 35 of our graduates, and we know what their practice plans are after residency. And of those, we're dealing with 91% have plans or are practicing in Wisconsin, which is almost double the number we had before with our regular medical school outcomes. Of those 91%, I've also been very impressed that 38% have gone back to their hometown. So as we get our community's best and brightest coming into medical school, we nurture that interest, keep them engaged in rural areas throughout medical school, get them into residency in the state, we see a good probability of them going back to their hometown. And, that I see as it being a huge success, because it's win-win for everybody in that area. So I guess if listeners on the radio are listening and they have a son or daughter or niece or nephew or grandchild that is interested in medicine, we'd love to help nurture that interest, get them into the WARM program, and keep them near home and meeting the needs of our citizens here in Wisconsin.
I know that medical students can amass a really kind of staggering amount of debt. Are there any kind of incentives, like some kind of loan forgiveness, that can be given to physicians who are willing to serve those underserved populations?
You're right. Medical school is very expensive. The average student graduating from medical school has a debt of around $150,000 for their educational expenses. Now, fortunately, physicians also are reimbursed well, and so that cash flow is something they can be managing quite well. Having said that, getting back to your question about incentives, the state has a loan repayment program that can offer reimbursement if they go to rural underserved areas to help pay off that debt. Many of the health systems and practices themselves are offering incentives for physicians that are willing to come and join and practice with a healthcare group in a rural area and incentivize going to that rural area. And the federal government also has other rural-focused scholarships and loan programs. So there are opportunities. They're not enough. I wish there were more. We have far more students looking for those opportunities than there are scholarships or loan repayment programs available. But the finances should not be a reason to stop people from doing this, because people do well and can offset the costs that they accumulate during medical school.
Well, Byron, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about the Academy's work.
Well, thank you for the interest, Judith, in our rural health, and we really appreciate sharing this with you.
That was Byron Krause, director of the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine. We've been learning about the program's efforts to place more graduating physicians in Wisconsin's rural areas.
Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University have edited the genes of human embryos using the new technology CRISPR. It's believed to be the first time this has been attempted in the United States.
This breakthrough raises a number of medical and bioethical questions. What impact could this technology have on health? Will it become widely requested? And who will have access to it?
Dr. Wendy Chung joins us now. She's a geneticist and the Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University. Dr. Chung, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, the technology that we're talking about today, it's a part of the gene editing technique using CRISPR. Can you tell us what CRISPR is and how it works?
Sure. It's a methodology that can be used to alter the genetic information in a very precise way, to be able to, if you will, go in and edit a gene, whether it's a gene with a problem, and bring it back into what the normal sequence is, or potentially to be able to change that gene and enhance it in some way.
And I understand that it's surprisingly simple to use this technology, not necessarily the way it's been used in Oregon, but that the technology itself is not as complicated as you might think.
Sure. So it's something that's now been, I'll use the word scalable. So it's used in many, many laboratories, literally hundreds of laboratories around the U.S. as well as internationally. It's quite precise, much more precise than our old methods of altering genes were. So what I mean by that is it's able to very surgically go in and alter a specific gene at a specific location with less effect in terms of what we call off-target effects or having sort of collateral damage, if you will, in terms of altering other genes. And that's part of the great promise of using this technology in the future for genetic conditions.
When you talk about the great promise, can you tell us what the goal is, what the big dreams are of science when we talk about using gene editing?
Well, certainly not just in the case of altering embryos, but generally we're becoming much more we understand much better the human genome and what genes are associated with diseases and specifically, where those different changes are, those mutations. But that's just the first step. It's the big first step in terms of knowing what to focus on and where to target. But one of the hopes that many both families or individuals with genetic conditions and many doctors like myself have is that if we did have technology to be able to return those genes to normalcy, that we might be able to restore the function, be able to make people healthy that would be either predisposed or already have these genetic conditions. It might be able to do it with a very common tool, almost like a gene scalpel. We wouldn't have to create new pills or new therapies for every single disease. There would be one sort of sweeping way of being able to treat these conditions. So that's the hope just in general about using the technology. For this group, it's also about, thinking about, is there you know, can you do this literally almost from the point of conception? So can you do this so early on that you fix this in a permanent way and be able to do it, you know, even before the embryo or the fetus starts developing?
How big a deal would you say this news is from Oregon Health and Science University, the editing using CRISPR of a human embryo? What does this represent?
Well, it's not the first time it's been done. This has been done before in China. I think we learned from that experiment that it wasn't quite as precise as any of us would have liked. There were some things that were what we call off-target effects, and that's sobering because in the early days of gene therapy that used some other, if you will, scalpels that weren't quite as precise, we know that several of the individuals that were part of those studies actually died as a result of those studies. Some of them developed leukemia. Some of them died even literally days after the procedure was started. So it's not a benign treatment that we're trying here in these early sort of days. And so we have to be very cautious and very careful that we're not trading essentially one disease or one condition for another that might ultimately be fatal. So the studies that were done in China, number one, taught us in terms of from a safety point of view, we need to be careful and do this, you know, in a stepwise fashion. This clearly is not going to cure these genetic diseases overnight. But the other part of this is that, you know, scientists have been discussing this with the public because it very much needs to be a discussion in the public square in terms of whether or not this is something, for instance, that we should be not just fixing, if you will, heart cells or brain cells or kidney cells, but literally, you know, fix the what would be passed on from generation to generation, what we call the germline. And that has bigger implications because then if you change something, it's not just affecting that person, but it's affecting potentially generations to come. And this could be either in terms of fixing a gene for kidney disease or heart disease, but it could also be enhancements. So it could be things in terms of making a stronger athlete, making someone who's faster or taller or has different hair color or eye color. So I think we need to think very carefully about that and, you know, again, have the discourse in terms of if we want to set any limits in terms of what this should or shouldn't be used for.
We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now, professor of pediatrics and medicine at Columbia University, talking about news that researchers in Oregon have been able to use gene editing technology, the CRISPR technology, on embryos for the first time in the United States. I should say that these are human embryos. And Dr. Chung, you talked about the debate and some of the questions being raised, and you said this needs to happen in the public square because these are big questions that could have far-reaching consequences. How do we go about having this discussion?
Well, I think it starts with what you're doing right now, which is fantastic. The public needs to hopefully get the facts in terms of what can be done, what can't be done, to realize, you know, what the potential implications for this are in the long term and to be forward thinking of that, because small steps now could mean big steps in the future. I do think, you know, leveraged on the one hand are that there are an awful lot of people with, in many cases, very rare genetic conditions that are searching very desperately to find cures and find answers and to be able to hope that the next generation won't have to deal with some of the conditions their children and family members had. So on the one hand, this, you know, has great, great promise and great potential. And so for many individuals, they've thought about using this in circumscribed, very specific indications or reasons. But on the other hand, it's somewhat of a slippery slope. So what is, you know, how burdensome is a disease? What's the difference between a disease and simply differences between one individual or another? Take something like autism. Many people would say that autism is simply a difference, from one person to another and how the brain works. And many people with autism are brilliant, incredibly gifted. And, you know, we shouldn't be stifling that or trying to get rid of genes that would predispose people like that. On the other hand, there are certain people, autism is a spectrum. There are certain people who have autism that, they can't speak. They have seizures. They have many other health issues. And, you know, many parents feel that that's a significant burden for them. So, you know, it's a discussion we have to have. You know, where do you draw that line, as I said, between what's a disease, what's just a normal difference, and what's impactful enough that we should go to such extremes to be able to start altering our human genes.
And what about the embryos themselves that are used in this research? What can you tell us about them and any concerns about the ethics using human embryos?
Well, certainly there are many people that have concerns, you know, that would consider an embryo a potential life and something that, you know, is quite sacred. You know, this could grow up to be a person, you know, like you or I. And in terms of couples that are desperately seeking to have a child, you know, this could be important in terms of their future. There are certainly many embryos that are generated for couples that are going through assisted reproduction. So there are, if you will, extra embryos that right now are either being discarded at the, you know, it is the choice of that couple to discard them or donating them for research. But it is, again, I think an individual interpretation about, is that a life? Is it a potential life? Is that sacred? You know, what can be done with that? Right now, from a legal point of view, research can be done on human embryos. But again, it's something that as a society, we need to think about what limits we might want to put on that.
It's my understanding that the embryos in this particular experiment, in this work, were not embryos that would have been able to be viable, to be carried to term. Is that your understanding?
Well, it is true that in terms of many of the embryos that are generated through in vitro fertilization, many of them will not survive. They have, if you will, you know, other problems. And so, you know, they are trying to, if you will, recycle in terms of the products. But again, you know, there are some people that would say, even if in circumstances, you know, that is a potential life, even if it might be a different potential life, and, you know, some people would say they just shouldn't be used, period.
What kind of concerns do you see about whether this becomes a class issue, whether there could be a society of have and have nots, not only maybe the children who have the benefit of living maybe without a disorder they might otherwise have had, but what if we get into the designer realm of babies, and what if that's only available to people with a lot of money, if insurance, say, wouldn't cover it typically? What do you think about those areas?
Absolutely. So I think that's one of the most important questions to think about from an ethical point of view and a access to care or access to resources point of view. So if you think about it, and I'm just going to use one example. So that's very public. You know, Angelina Jolie has in her family a hereditary breast cancer gene. And I'm not making any specific comments about her, but just to say it's an example that some people are familiar with. There are people who might say, well, you know what, I'd like to be able to prune my family tree and make sure that future generations don't have to worry about an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. On the other hand, that's not something that's, you know, has to be a life-threatening problem. You know, we have ways of being able to prevent cancer. I take my hat off to Ms. Julie in particular because she took measures to be able to minimize her risk of future cancer. So there are interventions that are quite effective, but, you know, they're not trivial. You know, they can require, or in some cases women choose to remove their breasts or remove their ovaries that are healthy, and that can be a very big, impactful thing. So, you know, you could say, well, you know, I could just very easily snip out that bad gene from my genome and I could replace it with a good gene, and then I don't have to worry about it, you know, for all of my daughters or my granddaughters or anyone else in the family. On the other hand, going through this technology, and there's sort of a step forward from that today, which we call in vitro fertilization with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So in this case, it's not actually editing the genes. It's not changing the genes, but it is selecting among a group of embryos the ones that genetically don't have the predisposition to that genetic condition. So that's a technology that's already available today. It doesn't involve tinkering with the genes. It doesn't involve necessarily destroying any of the embryos. So I think most people feel ethically that that's, you know, a viable option right now. But I'll just say that right now, that's something that's not commonly covered by insurance. That's oftentimes, depending on where you live, $20,000 to $30,000 per cycle to be able to do that. And already there is a group of have and have-nots in terms of who can use that technology for anything that might be as impactful as Tay-Sachs disease, the disease that results in children that will almost certainly die of a very severe neurological condition in the first few years of life, to couples that use it for things like, you know, BRCA, BRCA1 or 2. And, you know, beyond that, beyond just correcting what people would say and agree are disease genes, there's the idea of enhancement. You know, so could you do this to, as I was saying before, potentially select for, you know, someone who might be taller, someone who might be shorter, depending on what you prefer, someone who might be more intelligent, more outgoing, might be more athletic, you know, whatever those characteristics are, where I would say are differences in normal. You know, no one is good or bad. They are just differences, but being able to select for that in a positive or, you know, what some people call those designer babies or enhancement. And surely that's something that, you know, I guess is not going to be covered by insurance to do this, will be, you know, something that people will have to pay out of pocket to do it. And so will there be different classes of individuals, you know, people that can have not only children who are free of disease, but might be super in some way? And will it also set up then differences in terms of disabilities? Will people in society think about individuals who are disabled or have differences that have impact on their health? Will they think of them differently? Will they say, you know, well, your parents weren't responsible enough to be able to have healthy children, they had you? Will it, you know, change in terms of any access to educational opportunities, employment opportunities, housing, you know, anything like that?
We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now. She's the Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University. With us now to talk about the news that researchers in Oregon have been able to use gene editing technology on human embryos for the first time in the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of researchers using this technology? Do you think that people should have the option to use gene editing on their embryos, or do you think nature should take its course? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about the potential benefits and the bioethical concerns about using gene editing technology on embryos. Researchers in Oregon just became the first in the United States to use this technology on human embryos. We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now. She's a professor of pediatrics and medicine at Columbia University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this gene editing technology? And do you think that you would use this technology to alter genes if there's some kind of condition in your family that you would prefer not be passed down? What impact do you think this could have on medicine? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Chung, we talked earlier about the potential for this sort of gene editing technology. What about the limitations?
Well, certainly the limitation, as I said, is it's very early days. Although I would like to say that we can, like I said, with like a scalpel go in and make a very specific change, there are some limitations. Sometimes we do make that change in an embryo. We make it in one cell, but it's not present in all of the cells, so we haven't completely fixed all of the cells within that. There may be circumstances in which we think we fixed it, but we've actually made some other edit someplace else within the genome, someplace else in the genetic information that could have other impacts in terms of health or longevity. So it clearly we need to study it, not just in humans, but if one is going to try this in terms of very careful studies, being able to see long-term what the outcomes are, and do this also in things besides humans first, being able to do it in other mammals and other organisms.
Right, and this is, as you said, it's early on, and in the United States, a first step on human embryos. What are the next steps specifically that get us towards some of those loftier goals that we have down the road?
Well, I do think not just doing it in embryos, but there are many, many researchers who are thinking about doing gene editing within what we call somatic cells, or in other words, not starting out with the developing embryo, but thinking about, can you do this in blood cells, for instance, for a person who has a blood disorder, take those cells out of the body, fix them, put them back into the body of the individual. So I think there are many researchers already working on that now that will cure individuals who right now already suffer from and have those conditions. I think there's going to be a lot of work done on that to be able to, as I said, first in whether they're mice or other animals, non-human primates, to be able to see, does that effect last? Are there any other unexpected implications or repercussions from doing that? I think a lot more of that's going to be done well before we get to the point of doing this in embryos that might ultimately, you know, lead to humans, you know, actual developed humans. So, and there's a lot of promise for it, for using it to cure human diseases and being able to take care of people who are already with us, much less the next generation.
Among scientists, I imagine that the concerns might be slightly different than the public at large or among politicians. Among scientists, what do you see as the biggest stumbling blocks?
Well, I think among scientists, number one is, I think, you know, a lot of scientists can get creative, and I think that's a wonderful thing, to be able to think about how to solve problems in new ways. The public actually has an impact on science, though, in terms of determining scientific funding. So whether it's monies that come from the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation, the public discourse does shape what we do in science, in the sense of you have to have money to be able to develop these technologies, do the experiments that are necessary. And I think it's very important to, as I said, as a society, decide what's in bounds and out of bounds in terms of where we want this to go. You know, I think, like I said, some of us, I think, have concerns about using it for things that, you know, are, I would say, more trivial in terms of enhancement, that the risks are greater than the potential benefits from doing that, and that sometimes scientists try and, you know, get ahead of themselves. They may be overly confident in terms of what they can do and predict. And we certainly don't want to do anything that's going to put the future generation at risk.
How far off is this technology? It seems like it's moving quickly, but in reality, how far off? It's a guess at this point, but how far do you think we are from being able to, say, remove a gene that would predispose someone to breast cancer?
Well, I think from a very technical point of view, this can be done today. I mean, in terms of just literally doing the gene editing, designing what we call the guide RNAs, being able to do the CRISPR-Cas9 experiments, and being able to, if you will, snip out and correct that gene. That, as I, you know, said, is done every day in laboratories across the United States and around the world. I think doing it specifically in the circumstance of an embryo, you know, just at the very first second cell stage, doing it at that stage is something, obviously, this is, you know, really monumental in terms of doing it in the United States specifically. But being able to do all the follow-on experiments are necessary to demonstrate the safety and efficacy of that. None of that has been done whatsoever. And, you know, it's challenging because when you think about this, you don't just want to say 9 months of outcome data to see, you know, that a baby goes born from this. You want to be looking well, well into the future, you know, being able to let whatever it is that has this gene therapy, let it age up, let it live a full life course, and be able to see what those, you know, long-term, are there any other unexpected consequences from this.
So a lot of ground to cover there. Dr. Chung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Wendy Chung, Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University.